Hello, everybody out there in Internet Radio Land. This is Blake Ruby, your host for the show Gods and Goddesses. How are y'all doing? I'm doing okay. I had a good week. All kinds of things going on I'm going to tell you about. I just came from the store a little ago. It's been a pretty good day for me so far, Saturday. It was pouring rain. It's been raining pretty hard here in San Antonio for the last 3 days. We had a storm, I think it was Wednesday night or Thursday night, I forget. It knocked the power out a couple of times in our area. And I think Friday wasn't too bad. It rained just a little bit, but last night it began raining again. And then this morning, like about at 10 o'clock, it came down. It was pouring. It was just huge amounts of rain came down. And I was in the patio. I had just mopped the floor, and I was practicing singing. I am a really good singer. I think I could become famous. I really do. There's some people, and I know I sang in my last show, but you know, sometimes I'll go for days without singing because I get discouraged. You know, I don't have my technique right or something. You know, I mean, I can sing these songs beautifully. But I guess when you get up there in the upper levels, you know, to tweak yourself, it's a hard process. It's a slow process. But anyway, so one of the things I've been doing a lot recently is watching YouTube. That has replaced my television viewing. There's so much good stuff on YouTube. And I don't really have a lot to talk about, but I'll just talk about anything that comes to mind, which sometimes I do. You know, it's kind of like, it doesn't matter. I don't need to have something prepared. I like to be able to talk extemporaneously, you know. Nothing planned, just anything that comes to mind, I'll branch off and talk about it. So I was watching some old videos from the 80s of Ozzy Osbourne. And he had that band, the Blizzard of Oz, after Black Sabbath, you know. He found Randy Rhoads, who was a really great guitar player. This was like 1980, 81, 82. At that time, I was living in San Diego. And I joined the Army in 82, and 22 years, the next 22 years in the Army. But even when I was in my first duty assignment in Germany, Aschaffenburg, Germany, I was a pretty big metal fan, you know, heavy metal, rock and roll, hard rock. I don't know, I just kind of relate to that better than any kind of music. I love all music, you know, classical, jazz, R&B, but hard rock and heavy metal, I relate more to that than anything else. So I remember I went to an Ozzy Osbourne concert, when I was there in Germany from 82 through 84. And I saw Metallica when they were just starting out. And I saw a group that was pretty popular back then called Y&T. And I saw a group called Twisted Sister. And they were just starting out, too. They became very famous later on in the 80s. But Ozzy Osbourne, I saw him, and this was just after. In fact, I'd seen Ozzy Osbourne in San Diego just before Randy Rhoads died in the airplane crash. And I found out today, I was watching these old videos. He had a guitarist by the name of Jake E. Lee, who replaced Randy Rhoads. And, you know, he had to be a pretty hot guitarist to replace Randy Rhoads, because Randy Rhoads was great. You know, he was totally awesome. Have you ever seen, check out some of his videos on YouTube. You know, Ozzy Osbourne, I mean, he was very, very gifted. I mean, I'm a heavy metal guitarist aficionado. I could tell you who I think are the best in the world. You know, I'll do that right now, in fact. I think number one, of course, Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix, everyone says that, you know, he was the best. He had such an innovative, creative way of playing the guitar. You could play behind his head. You could pick with his teeth. You know, he could just, it was just a part of him. You know, I think he slept with his guitar, you know. He set it on fire, and he did all kinds of things with it. You know, it's like a part of his body. And so it requires a lot of effort. You got to practice day, morning, noon, and night, you know, all the time. And then I'll put in my top 10, maybe top 5, Eddie Van Halen. I saw him in concert a couple of times, and he was just awesome, you know. He was very creative, too, with his guitar playing, the way he would use both hands, fingers on both hands, tapping away at the strings. That was a kind of unique sound. And Randy Rhoads, of course, I would say I put him in my top 10. Yngwie Malmsteen, he's a European, I think a Scandinavian fellow. He's great. And then Joe Satriani, of course, he's in my top 5, actually. Joe Satriani is just totally excellent, you know, great guitar player. And Jakey Lee, I didn't realize. I saw him in my mind's eye, remembering back all 1983 when I saw them in concert. He was up there on the stage, and he was just rocking and rolling. But I checked out some of his YouTube videos today from 83, 84, and 86. And by the way, that was back in the days when I used to drink alcohol. You know, I can't judge anybody for drinking. You know, I've been through a lot myself. And I gave it up in 1988. My mother and my dad used to drink. They were alcoholics. And there's a lot of people that have had problems with alcohol. You know, some people haven't touched it. That's a good thing, I think. Ozzy Osbourne had a song called Demon Alcohol. And I've seen it myself. You know, just no offense to anybody out there that likes to drink in moderation, you know, or just drink, period. But for me, it was about to ruin my life, and I nipped it in the bud, you know, before it got out of control. And I got hurt or killed. I got a DUI one time. But anyway, there's another song by a man named Anon. You know, it's kind of like an R&B rapper. Back in the early 90s, I think, called Blame It on the Alcohol. You can blame a lot of things on the alcohol. And everybody's their own island, and you're a god in the making. If you choose to go that route, I can't judge you, like I said, because I used to do it myself. But Ozzy Osbourne had that song, Demon Alcohol, and that was true. I mean, I was reading today, when he used to drink, he was mean, ugly. And Jakey Lee, he was on this couple of videos, I was watching him play, and he's such a good guitarist. Oh, my God. Fingers moving up and down the fret, just like at lightning speed, you know, and just sounding so good. But then Ozzy Osbourne would come over and grab him by the hair and just yank his head back and forth. I mean, hard, you know. And I was thinking, man, that was pretty mean, you know. But Jakey Lee kind of shook it off. I guess when you're buddies and friends with a band member, you know, you can roughhouse a lot, wrestle, and, you know, even hit each other. But, you know, sometimes you cross the line and you can get too violent, you know. Leonard Skinner, I remember them, they used to get into fights all the time, you know, and then they'll drive their cars down the road after drinking and get into accidents, you know, and then they had that airplane crash, and my God, it was rough for them. Ozzy Osbourne, they say he punched Randy Rhoads one time just before the airplane crash, you know, that might have, who knows, persuaded him to do something, you know, get in an airplane with a guy. Wasn't a really good pilot, from what I heard. You know, it took a chance getting in that airplane, and the guy had probably been drinking, you know, and maybe they smoked a joint. And The guy was, he just lost control of the aircraft, you know. That's nothing to fool around with, an aircraft. Have you ever taken any flying lessons? I have. It's, you got to watch what you do, you know. There's all, you got to really have your stuff together, fly an airplane. It's not something you can joke around with, you know. That's what that guy was doing. Randy Rosen should have never gotten that airplane with that guy, but some things are meant to be. But anyway, Ozzy was mean when he was drunk, he used to drink. And they say he did stuff like bite the head off a bat or a dove, you know, stepped on baby chicks. Maybe that was Alice Cooper. I forget what army boots on. But Jakey Lee, who was a great guitarist. They say Ozzy Osbourne, when he wasn't drinking, was a sweet, gentle, kind guy. But once he hit the bottle, you know, Jakey Lee said he didn't like partying with Ozzy because, you know, he'd get violent and start doing crazy stuff. And I was watching him today and he, from a festival back in 1983, too. And he wasn't very good. He was singing very poorly at that time. You know, being an accomplished singer myself, I could tell, you know, that he was missing all the high notes and he was just going crazy on the stage and not really paying attention to his singing. He would walk over, put the microphone on the mic stand, pull it off right away, go walking around some more, put the microphone back on the microphone stand, pull it off right away. He would do that continuously, like on like a nervous habit, you know. And finally, I was watching that today and I said, I don't want to watch that anymore. It's kind of distracting. But I guess you can blame it on the alcohol, like the song says. There's so many things you can blame on alcohol, and especially suicide. Now, I don't know all the facts and figures, my friends out there, but I'll tell you, in my opinion, from what I've learned, and I'm a well-read person, a well-educated person. I can read very well. You know, I can write very well. I've done a lot of research. And it's my opinion that most of the people that commit suicide nowadays are under the influence of alcohol. Now, that's something to remember. I'm not judging you, you know. You like your glass of wine or two every now and then. I can't judge you. That's fine. You know, I'm just saying. Some people can't control it. They can't drink in moderation. And that demon, just like in Ozzy Osbourne's song, Demon Alcohol, there is a demon out there that is associated with alcohol. You have to be very careful. You know, they come after the ones that it gets out of control with. And when you get really drunk, if you don't believe me, what I'm about to tell you, check it out, this book called, by an author named George Ritchie. He had a near-death experience. And I'm a near-death experience kind of guy. I love to hear the stories of people have, you know. And you can go into the science of it, and some people say, skeptics say, it's just the function of a dying brain, you know, these near-death experiences. The neurons are firing as the brain is dying, and so they have these visions as a result of the dying brain, the neurons firing, etc., etc. But there was one woman, and I forget the exact name of the surgery, but they have to put the person in ice and get their body temperature below like 70 degrees. It's a kind of surgery where they go into the brain, and I think she had an aneurysm, and there's a specific name for it, but I don't remember it. And so the heart is stopped. They have to stop the heart. They have to freeze. They have to lower the body temperature. So for all intents and purposes, the brain is not functioning. The heart is stopped. And I guess there's a machine that's, I'm not sure if the heart is stopped or not, but I know that the brain, there's no blood going to the brain. And so this woman, she had this surgery, and she was able to, she said that she popped out of her body and was looking down at it. And she said she could see the doctors working on her. She identified some instruments she hadn't seen before the surgery. after the surgery, she said there's one instrument that looked like an electric toothbrush. And she said she went up near the ceiling. She was looking down. And so much for the brain, you know, the theory that near-death experiences are the result of a dying brain. That kind of disproved that. Also, there was a woman that was in a hospital, and she had a pretty serious kind of surgery. I forget what it was, hysterectomy something. And she went out of her body during the surgery, and she went up through the ceiling. It was like three floors on this hospital, up to the roof. And there she stood on the roof, and she looked around, and she saw this one. She saw a red sneaker sitting on the roof of this hospital. And she kind of fixated on it. What is a red sneaker doing up here? So she came down into her body, you know, came back to life, so to speak. And when she was revived, one of the nurses came in. And she was talking with a nurse and relating her experience to him. And she said, "Will you do me a favor? Could you just, I just had this almost like a dream. You know, I left my body, went up to the roof of the hospital. I was looking around. I saw this red sneaker up there. Could you do me a favor? Go up there and just take a look." So the nurse said, "Oh, dang, you know, okay, well, I'll do it." So he went up there, looked around, there was this red sneaker. He came back, grabbed it, came back down. She said, "That's it." Now, you might say, the skeptics might say, "Well, she planted it up there, you know, she put it up there, or she'd been up on the roof before." Now, what's a patient going to be doing on the third floor of a hospital, you know, on the roof of a hospital? It's not even supposed to be there. It's possible, I suppose, but, you know, skeptics will always come up with a reason for something they don't want to believe in. They always take the opposite stance, you know. Suffice it to say, my friends, that, you know, these near-death experiences, I know, I just don't believe, I know they're real. You'll find out one day, we'll find out. You know, if you're a human being and you've got a heart and a brain, one day you're going to die. I'm sorry, you know, eventually you will. You're not invincible. Some people think they're invincible. It's hard to believe. You know, something that you don't have any information about, you don't have any experience about. Anyway, back to Ozzy Osbourne. So, you know, now he's got a show. And his wife, she manages him. I don't think he's drinking anymore, and I'm not drinking anymore either, you know, so I can't judge him, can't blame him for some things he did. But he was pretty mean when he used to drink, you know. And J.K. Lee, I know that he got gypped out of the royalties for the Bark at the Moon album. That was like, there was The Blizzard of Oz, it was Diary of a Madman, there was the Bark at the Moon album, then there was The Ultimate Sin. And I had Bark at the Moon, I had The Ultimate Sin. I was really into Ozzy at that time. He's a pretty cool guy, you know, but there's a lot of people that when they drink, they get mean, they get ugly, you know, do weird stuff. My father, when he used to drink, he was very morose. He was bitter. He would swear a lot, you know, always swearing. But he was never violent. You know, he never hit my mom. He never abused my mom. Never abused us. He was a World War II veteran, you know, so he had PTSD. And he would come home. Drink hard liquor. Oh, my God. He would drink till he passed out, kind of. I mean, he had some pretty weird stuff that he experienced in World War II. You know, weird, I guess that's the best way to describe it. Some pretty traumatic stuff, you know, that he experienced killing men, you know. I know he was in a gunfight. He pulled his gun faster than the German did. He shot him before he shot my father. And then he had a man, at least one man, die in his arms. You know, imagine how that would be. somebody that you know, maybe had a drink with the night before, and then you see the light just disappear from their eyes, you know, and they're gone. And then he was at Dunkirk, you know, they're being wiped out by the Germans. You know, thank God they had all those people that came to the rescue in those boats and they saved thousands of lives, you know, by deploying and bringing back the soldiers that were stranded on the beach. You know, the German Messerschmitts were picking them off. You know, they saw this going on. All that, all those memories throughout the years, you know, you're just not the same man when you come back from war. You know, you're not the same. It's just not the same. You get used to being shot at, you know, and shooting back. You can hear the bullets whizzing around. It's not a pleasant thing, you know. It makes you bitter. It just turns you into a mean person, you know, when you think someone's trying to kill you. Fortunately, you know, I've never been through that, and other people haven't either. Yeah. And when I think about it, I think there's really no good reason for having war. None whatsoever. You know, here we are. We're supposed to be one. You know, there's a song by Frankie Beverly. He's a really cool R&B artist. He's been around. He's never hit the top mainstream R&B, you know, like some like Beyonce and some others, Marvin Gaye. But actually, Marvin Gaye got him going. And he's got a song, We Are One. And I read about it in the near-death experience. And that's a really great song. Check it out, too. And it's true. We are one. We are connected in some way. We're separate, but still we're connected in a way. We're like, we're all human beings. You know, we've got two hands, got two arms, two legs. You know, we have the same organs, you know, but we're separate. Yep, we're one of a mold, you know. And I was telling you before on previous shows about this really neat near-death experience, one of my favorites by a man named Lou Famoso. He writes about it. You can read about it on the internet, also in the near-death.com website run by Kevin Williams. He relays his experience, you know. Here's a guy going down the road, coming back from Vietnam. He served two tours in Vietnam. And on his way to a party on a Saturday night in his brand new Mustang, Ford Mustang. And I think it was a 64, you know, just with a 289 cubic inch engine, four-speed shifter, you know, nice car. Going 100 miles an hour, just checking it out, you know, new car. And I don't know if you know anything about those cars, but they're very front heavy. So not a lot of weight in the back. And if you have like some bumps on the road, you're going 100 miles an hour. You know, they'll start bouncing up and down in the front, you know. With all that weight, it bounces out of control. And he lost control and flipped end over end like several times, you know. Going 100 miles an hour, it's going to take a while for the car to stop. And he didn't wear a seat back then in 64. I mean, not a lot of people wore seatbelts, you know, so he got thrown from the car. He had a huge wound in his head, a gaping head wound, you know. Hey, that's what happens, right? And you got breaking glass and plastic and metal, you know, being crunched, and you're inside, right? So he left his body. Some friends going to the same party, these females in the car, they came by, they saw the car crash. They freaked out, of course, and they picked him up and took him to the hospital. And so he left his body. He said there's two of him, two. The one, him that was inside the car, you know, with blood coming out of his head wound. And then the other, him, that was looking down on the body that was dying. He got to the hospital, and same thing, you know, he was walking behind the women as they were freaking out and screaming, and the people in the hospital came out and got him, put him on a gurney, brought him inside, so took him to surgery, and they kind of, they bagged and tagged him, you know, put a sheet over his head. And so he had this near-death experience where he found himself all of a sudden in this beautiful place, just light everywhere, I mean, just made of light, it seemed like, you know. Does that remind you of any place? Any place close by that's made of light? Well, I'll let you guess if you don't know. I'm not going to tell you this time. Anyway, so he said all of a sudden there was this ball of light that started coming towards him, and it got bigger and bigger. At first it looked like a billiard ball, and then a basketball, and a beach ball, brilliant gold light coming towards him. And then when it got right in front of him, it stopped and materialized in a whole being of light, like about twice the size of an ordinary man. And there's a couple of things that he told Lou Famoso, and that's a cool name, isn't it? Lou Famoso. I don't know too many people with the last name of Famoso, but he, one thing he said was, this was not right away, but later he said, man will pray, P-R-E-Y, on man until man learns to pray, P-R-A-Y, for man. Pray, pray. And that's a very intelligent thing to say, don't you think? And it's true that where we are nowadays, the future of the world, my friends, depends on your ability to pray for your fellow man. You think you can do it? Are you up to the task, fellow co-creator God in the making? It's true. Come on now. Don't be a young soul. Don't act like a young soul. Come on. I know there's a lot of you out there that had previous lives. You just can't remember, because one of the requirements to be born on this planet is that you go through what they call the river of oblivion. And all your past life memories are erased. And you can't remember them. And it's a good thing you can't, because this is a very specific planet, learning environment. Right? So going back to the other thing that I have to assume that he was the creator, you know, the spirit father. And there's a spirit mother, too, because, you know, you being a co-creator God in the making, you have a soulmate. You were born with a soulmate. You were created with a soulmate. And I'm not 100% sure about this, but I think the goal is to get back to your soulmate. And that's the ultimate way of creating with your soulmate. And it sounds kind of incestuous, but I don't believe that's true. When you get to the spirit lands, you're looking for your soulmate so that then you can hook up and then create your own spirit children. That may not be true. Let's just say, but then again, you can have spirit children with a member, a spirit of the opposite sex, you know, by that same kind of process, which is known as merging of the spirit. Sylvia Brown talked about it a lot in her books, you know, the great psychic medium, late psychic medium, Sylvia Brown. But I still think that when you're born, you know, when your spirit and soul is created, you're created in two parts, two halves of a whole. And the objective, I'm going to go out on a limb and say, yes, you got to get back to your soulmate if you want to, you know, find your own stretch of open space, infinite space there, and create your own solar system, right? And then when you merge your spirits and you speak those words, just like it says in the Bible, in the beginning was the Word, and I'm using words right now, and the Word was with God, and everything was created with the Word. That's why it's important to be careful with your words, my friends. But the other thing that creator, it could have been the Spirit Father, it could have been both of them together. You know, the original creator of the universe, the supreme creator who initiated the Big Bang, is both male and female. Just like angels are male and female, they're androgynous. Male and female. Is that a hard concept to understand, both in one, you know? it shouldn't be. But one thing I told him, it could be also spirit father or spirit mother. And one thing, the other thing I told him was, it kind of like put a vision in his mind about this huge, beautiful plate made of crystal. Imagine, if you will, a plate maybe about 5 feet in diameter or even 10 feet in diameter, just a beautiful colored, all the colors of the rainbow. And then it shattered into thousands of pieces. Thousands of pieces, and then it came back together again. And the point was that we are all parts of the whole. We are like, each one of us is a tiny piece of that whole. And indeed we are, you know, the original creator of the universe created everything. There's nothing that exists today that wasn't created or imagined in the beginning when there was darkness and silence before the Big Bang, imagined by the Supreme Creator, and then by the power of his, her will came into existence, and so the first solar system was formed. So we are indeed one. You know, and that's why it's important to pray for each other. I do all the time. I pray all the time. Here's a prayer, for example, you know, Supreme Creator, you are awesome. You know, I want to thank you for the miracles of all creation. Here we are in the spiral arm of the Milky Way galaxy, approximately 15 billion light years from the center of the universe. You know, we're evolving around the center. Our solar system is revolving around the center of the Milky Way galaxy, and our Milky Way galaxy is revolving around the center of the universe. Creator, you are so awesome, and you're worthy of praise. You know, thank you, a thousand thank yous for all that you've done. You are magical, you are powerful, you are omniscient. And we don't think about you too often, Creator. You know, today I got a chance to see just how beautiful and powerful Mother Nature is. It was pouring rain. There was lightning over in the distance. And a planet is an incredible thing. You've created a wonderful planet, a jewel of a planet here on planet Earth. You know, planet Earth is a jewel among planets, I think, in the universe. I'm sure there are other planets just like this, different, others that are different in many ways. And there's so much life here. Oh, I love talking about this, all the life. Did you know there's over a million types of insects here on Earth? And in the Amazon basin, there, in like a few square acres, there are like over a million types of insects there in the Amazon, by the Amazon River, in the Amazon basin there. And then they're in the oceans and the seas and the rivers and lakes. Think of all the different types of fish, all kinds of fish, big, small, different sizes, each one beautifully and individually created with a heart that pumps blood throughout his body, you know, eyes that see. And then there are birds, over 10,000 types of birds. Think of all the different types of birds, from huge birds, cranes that fly, geese, eagles, hawks, cardinals, red-winged blackbirds, hummingbirds, sparrows, finches, blackbirds, crows, ravens, so many different types of birds. Again, with eyes that can see, you know. Imagine creating an eye for a being that they can see, just like we can see. You have to have an incredible amount of intelligence to create an eye. I mean, mankind in all of its technological glory and splendor, and we've been able to do amazing things over the last 150 years, technologically wise, you know. Our cell phones, our computers, our cars, our aircraft, you know, sending spaceships to the moon, to the Galileo spacecraft went to Jupiter and filmed, you know, Jupiter and its moon, the Cassini space mission, you know, sent a spacecraft to Saturn and put a probe on one of its moons Titan, you know, and they were able to beam back signals and tell us that the content of Titan's atmosphere has a lot of methane in it. On the surface of the moon, there's a pool of methane, so it has its own atmosphere, even being like 5 million miles away, you know, or more than that, actually. I think it's like 90 million miles away. Mars is 33 million miles away, I think, if I'm not mistaken. Venus, not so far. Mercury. And so even with all our technological glory, and indeed, that's some pretty amazing stuff, right? I can talk with my stepdaughter who lives in Tokyo right now on the same phone I'm talking to you. And still, we don't know how to create simple seed, like an apple seed or a seed for any kind of tree or maybe an ant. Take it like a very small insect which has legs and eyes and metabolism. It can reproduce, it can eat, defecate, you know, breathe air. I think, you know, ants have lungs, I believe. They do have lungs. A little creature like that, I mean, that's so small, you know, so tiny, but wonderfully made, carefully made, you know. And then there are reptiles. I killed a rattlesnake the other day in my neighbor's yard. It was on, I think it was Thursday, and we just had that heavy rainfall. And there's a lot of them behind our backyard here. We've got like a 24-acre park. And I was working, it was getting close to the end of the work day, about 3:30, and the doorbell rang, and it was a little girl from two houses down. She said, could you help us, please? There's a rattlesnake in the front yard. So I said, sure. So I went and grabbed our rake, and I've killed some snakes before. It's something you don't mess around with. They're very dangerous. You get bitten by a rattlesnake, it'll ruin your day, I guarantee you. You'll have to go to the emergency room right away. Got to be careful walking around here in Texas, especially at nighttime in the summer when it's hot. Fortunately, we've got cats and dogs, and so one of our dogs has killed a rattlesnake before. So I went over there and I killed it with the rake, you know. Took me a few blows, but I don't like doing it. If anybody dislikes killing things, it's me. You know, if you're out there listening and you say, well, that's cruel, you know, I don't like killing animals. Well, neither do I. But, you know, if it comes into your yard, I'm sorry. You know, out in the wilderness, I'm walking down a path, I see a rattlesnake, I'll leave it alone. But when it comes into my yard and threatens my pets, or, I mean, this woman, she almost stepped on it. She almost stepped on it. Some people aren't reasonable, you know. You shouldn't kill anything. Yeah, well, I don't, usually, you know. I don't like killing the fly. But I had to go kill that rattlesnake. You know, it was about a foot long, maybe 15 inches. It had a fairly large head. One bite from that, it could have, you know, there's also long-term complications when you think about getting bit by a rattlesnake. So please don't give me that. You know, you shouldn't have killed it. Because normally I wouldn't, you know, but when it comes into like a neighbor's yard or my yard, that's it. I'm sorry. I have to dispatch it as humanely as possible and bury it or throw it out in the back, behind the backyard. You know, maybe the coyotes will try and pick it up, you know. They're hungry enough, they will eat it, you know. And they asked me to do it. I told the lady, I walked over there with the rake, and I said, you know, I'm going to have to kill it. She said, yeah, I know. And you got to be careful because, yeah, rattlesnakes, the poison's very, very bad for the body, you know. Didn't like doing it. I've killed six before that one around my house here. Actually, one time I asked this one neighbor across the street. It was Christmas Eve. I think it was 2015. And my wife and I had just been to a Christmas Eve service. And we came back, and it was about maybe 8, 9 o'clock, Christmas Eve. And as we walked up to our front door, Jackie said, what's that sound? It sounded like water running. You know, like, looked around and there was no water coming from the hose or, you know, the hose bibs on the side of the house. That's what it sounded like, you know. And so I got closer and I looked underneath. We have this small little table on the porch, front porch. I said, I need to go up and get my flashlight. I think that might be a rattlesnake. So I ran up, got my flashlight, came back down, and there was this rattlesnake coiled up underneath the table. And the table, I mean, there was a space of maybe 3-4 inches. And so I looked underneath there, and sure enough, there was a rattlesnake. It must have been about 2-3 feet long, you know, coiled up in there. And so that was the first rattlesnake we had. And I saw some people across the street that were talking, you know, they were celebrating Christmas Eve. So I walked over and I said, excuse me, I've got a rattlesnake in my front porch. Does anybody know anything about how to kill him? So this one guy, he said, he was a big guy too. He had overalls on. He said, I'm from the country. We get them all the time. He said, I'll help you out. So he had that resolute look in his eye, you know, like, okay, let's go and go to war here, go to battle. I don't like saying that, war. I don't believe in war, but having to confront a pretty serious thing, you know. So he walked over there. We all did. And we started taking the stuff off the porch, and then he lifted up the table. And it stayed coiled, you know, and it's about close to 3 feet long, you know. And he asked me for my shovel. I had a shovel. So he got the shovel. He had his heavy boots on, too. And so he killed it, you know, and chopped off his head. And then he said, do you have an empty gallon container of milk? He said, you got to be careful. Even when you cut the head off a rattlesnake, it can still bite. And you get bitten, even when it's dead, you know, you get bitten and it'll inject venom into your body, and then you'll be out of commission for like 2-3 days at least, you know, and then there could be long-term complications down the road, too. So we very carefully put the decapitated head into a 1-gallon milk container, empty container, and we took the body of the rattlesnake. It was a very beautiful snake, too, you know, long snake, very dangerous. But we put it in, wrapped it up in a couple of bags, and put it in the trash, you know. That was my first experience with a rattlesnake. And then there was a baby rattlesnake that was outside the garage door in the garage. Of course, I couldn't tell it was a rattlesnake, and we had to whack it over the head with one of those dustbin things, you know, you sweep up the dust with. And then there was one in the front yard that was about maybe 10 inches long. My cat had been playing with it. And, you know, cats, they know how to handle, some cats know how to handle rattlesnakes. They wave their tails and it kind of hypnotizes them, and they can, you know, use their claws and rake them to death, you know. They're faster than rattlesnakes. That's why mongooses are so good killing cobras, you know. They can dispatch a cobra, you know, more than one, even one by itself. But when they team up, when there's like three of them, they're able to move in and move out so quickly, you know, and they can bite. They inflict bites, and then the snake just dies of too many bites, you know. But we had this one in the front yard, and I took a shovel to that one. I don't like doing it. I used to catch snakes when I was young, living in Canada. And we would go in New Brunswick, where I used to live, there wasn't any poisonous snakes. There weren't any poisonous snakes, but we used to go and catch these little red-bellied snakes and grass snakes and garter snakes. It was kind of fun. And the bigger snakes, sometimes they would bite, you know. It kind of hurt, you know. Their teeth were like little needles, like a needle prick, you know. And a little bit painful, but and it would draw blood, but not too bad. Here in Texas, oh my God, you know, they've got rattlesnakes, they've got cottonmouths, they've got copperheads. I've seen copperheads. I saw a copperhead one time in Fort Polk, Louisiana, when I was stationed there with the Army, but They have cottonmouths. I've seen cottonmouths here in some of the ponds they have. Water moccasins are no joke either. They'll ruin your day if you get bit by them. And then scorpions. Scorpions all the time. I killed two, like, over the last couple of weeks. And they were both large, about 2 inches long. This last one, last week, I was sat in the patio taking a break, and this one just came out from underneath this treadmill we've got here on the back porch, covered up by a tarp, you know. And so I just stepped on it. Can't mess around with a scorpion. My wife got stung by a scorpion 3 times. She picked up this dog bed that we had in the backyard, and she didn't look on the underneath of it. And so when she her leg, as she was walking away with it, the scorpion stung her 3 times in the thigh. And so she was out of commission for like a day. She, the pain, she took some Benadryl. And I hear one thing is good is, what's that stuff that you put on for poison ivy? That red stuff, I forget the name of it. Calamine lotion, I think that's it, yeah. Anyway, I was talking about the different types of life here on Earth and the different types of snakes and amphibians. There's about 9,000 types of amphibians, about 5,000 types of mammals. And then think about all the flowers. I mean, there's thousands of different types of beautiful flowers of all different colors, shapes, and sizes. And then trees, too, hundreds, of, not thousands, but hundreds, maybe thousands of types of trees around the world, you know. Beautiful, beautiful trees, some tall, some not so tall. I mean, the ones in California, the redwoods, go to be like 200-300 feet above the ground. And you have trees like here in Texas, you know, and I'm looking at right now, that are maybe, the biggest one is maybe 20 feet, 25 feet off the ground. They're very beautiful, you know, green leaves. And the trees here in Texas are kind of not as tall as in California, for sure. So if all that life here on Earth, the insects, the fish in the oceans, you know, sharks, whales, all kinds of 30,000, oh my God, living in the oceans, seas, rivers, and lakes. And then the reptiles and the birds and the amphibians and the mammals, if all that life happened by accident, anybody with a logical mind has to say that it could happen by accident anywhere in the universe. Case closed, you know? I mean, there you go. But people want proof. They always have to have proof. Proof of this, proof of that. They have to see it for themselves. They have to touch it for themselves in order to believe. You can't take it from someone else. Oh, I felt it. I touched it. Let me tell you, it's real. No, I got to believe it myself. I got to feel it for myself. I got to touch it myself. I got to see it for myself in order to believe. No, you have to bridge the gap between belief and knowledge. Okay, so you need NASA. Let me ask you, do you need NASA to discover life on a planet in our solar system and maybe a planet in a neighboring solar system? Do you need them to do that for you to finally internalize in your own being that there is life elsewhere? You need them to do that, even to spend billions of dollars doing that to satisfy your need to know that there is life elsewhere. When you look up into the sky at night and you see all those suns, stars, whatever you want to call them, they're really suns, not stars. But, you know, each one that you see up there in the evening sky, there are stars in the southern sky. It's true, there are. And each one of them is a complete, entire solar system with at least 9 planets, right? That's the magical number for the universe, number 9. My friends, don't forget that. Number 9. Number to be a song by the Beatles, number 9. It's the number of the universe. Anyway, so, well, you and I both know it didn't happen by accident, right? Because guess what? We're here too, as sentient beings. And there are other sentient beings out there. So if there are birds, let's say there's birds, there's all kinds of birds on other planets, right? In other planets around the universe, there's birds on other planets. But there's also human beings, and there's other kinds of beings. There's tall beings. There's 9 feet tall, 10 feet tall beings, hermaphrodite, male and female, like transgender. I love transgender people. They're awesome. They're born that way. Gay people, too. Most of them are born that way. But there are some that are the typical, stereotypical gray, you know, aliens. They shouldn't really call them aliens. They're people, kind of like us. People. Just think of them as people. You know, 5 feet tall, gray skin, big dark eyes, kind of pointed ears. And you have some that are wide, some that are short. You know, there's a race of human beings I've heard that are very advanced technologically, are able to, you know, travel here to Earth, have traveled, been here before in the past. They are three feet tall human beings, and very intelligent, you know, able to travel interdimensionally. There are beings that have skin that's like bark, scaly skin. Some that, all of them indigenous to the planets they belong to, you know. And so their bodies are created in accordance with their atmospheric conditions on their planet. So they might have like a horn on their forehead with an eye on the end of the horn because their atmospheric conditions necessitate for them to be that way. There's an intergalactic federation of sovereign planets out there, okay? Don't forget that we are like the kindergarten kids in the block, you know, here on planet Earth. Our civilization really hasn't reached the second letter of the word civilization in comparison to what's out there. These people that have been exploring the universe for millions of years, you know, and are capable of traveling at light speed and also interdimensionally going to a parallel universe where they can travel by the speed of thought, you know, them and their spacecraft. And they've been doing this routinely now for millions of years. So we're like, the kindergarten kid, you know. And yes, we've come a long way and we've developed ourselves technologically over the last, as I mentioned, 150 years or so. We've done some incredible things, but we've only just begun, really, you know. We've only just seemed like the tip of the iceberg as far as what we can do, what we're capable of. If we were to make contact with these extraterrestrial species and they're out there, they could share their technology with us. You know, as long as we were able to prove to them that we're not violent like we have been in the past, you know what I'm saying? All the wars we've had. Do I need to point them out to you again? But let me go back to, you know, saying all this life here happened by accident. It could happen by accident elsewhere. That's enough to prove to you that there is life out there. But let's just say there is a supreme creator who initiated the Big Bang. And that creator is powerful, magical, and knowledgeable enough to create all this life on Earth, right? All the life on Earth, then logically that creator is magical and powerful and knowledgeable enough to create either the same life or different life that we can't imagine. We can't imagine anywhere. Let me spell it out for you. A-N-Y-W-H-E-R-E. Anywhere in the universe. And the universe is a great big place, my friends. You know that, right? It's like 15 billion light years in diameter, 30 billion light years across from one end to the other. and the edges of infinite space are expanding. Hey, as we talk, as I talk right now, expanding. We're part of something that's really incredible that's going on, and we're just beginning to grasp, I'm just beginning to grasp the immensity of our situation. Each of us capable of dying. I don't want to sound morbid, but it's possible tomorrow might not be here for some people, you know? And then we go to the spirit lands. I don't want to die. I want to live, you know? Don't get me wrong. I want to live. I want to live to be a ripe old age if possible. You know, I went to the track today. I walked 400 meters, and I ran 200 meters. I'm a good runner. I love to run, you know, and I love to stay in shape and be fit and eat food. You know, I love eating food. I love life. I'm grateful, you know. And life is good, my friend. I wish you the best. Remember what I said, please, because my time is running out here. And remember to pray for each other. Just, are you brave enough, strong enough, pray for your fellow human being? Because that is the key. That is the key to loving one another. You know, love is what it's all about. Everyone will tell you that, but how do you love people? What is the key to loving people? Praying for them. Yeah, we are hotwired. We're hardwired to be able to pray. You are meant to pray. Prayer is your communication. All right. Thanks, Don. Prayer is your hotline to heaven, to your creator of your soul and spirit, your mother and father, God. All right. That's it for me. Take care, and may the supreme creator of the universe bless us all, everybody, all of his, her children. Talk to you next week. I love you. Bye-bye.